key players in these torrid tales, otherwise known as partners in crime.
Nikki Six. The dying could be easy. It was the living that I didn't know if I could do.
Founder, chief songwriter, and bassist for Motley Crue. Assiduous diary keeper and the anti-hero of this tale. A man who was so hooked on heroin and cocaine that he had to die twice before he began to contemplate a more positive lifestyle.
Tommy Lee. We all went to that dark fucking place at various times, but Nikki seemed to like it there more than any of us.
A.K.A. T-Bone. Motley Crue's drummer and Nikki's toxic twin. A fellow narcotics adventurer who shared all of Nikki's 80s addictions, except heroin.
Vince Neil. Nikki was spending a lot of time shooting up in the bathroom during the girls' sessions, and that suited me fine. It was the perfect time for me to record my vocals.
The singer of Nikki's lyrics in Motley Crue, and a man who spent most of the 80s hating the guts of his band's songwriter and bassist. The feeling was mutual.
Mick Mars. When I heard Nikki was dead, my first reaction was, I knew that fucking prick was going to do something like that.
Unassuming and reclusive Motley Crue guitarist who was forced to accept that his role in life was to be bullied, persecuted, and abused by his vindictive bandmates.
Deanna Richards. You never imagine your own family will plot against you to steal your son.
Nikki's mother, who endured an agonizingly long estrangement from her son after his troubled and turbulent childhood.
Cece Comer. Nikki was rude, full of himself. He just crushed me so many times. He was an asshole.
Once adoring little sister of Nikki, who accepts that their particular in-family dynamic was maybe not your average sibling relationship.
Tom Reese. I went to stay with Nikki once or twice, and the way of life he had was not to my liking.
Nikki's maternal grandfather, who, together with his late wife Nona, looked after Nikki in Idaho for long periods of his youth.
Doc McGee. As a parting joke, I'd said to Nikki, don't send us any girls in Nazi helmets and Gestapo boots, and he must have thought I meant it because they turn up in helmets but not the boots.
Former Motley Crue co-manager who described the physical violence he sometimes meted out to his troublesome charges as full contact management.
Doug Thaler.
Nikki showed me some gummy black substance he had that he claimed was some kind of exotic cocaine that he was going to snort. I thought, good luck snorting a gummy substance.
Partner to Doc McGee, and a man resigned to receiving early hour phone calls from Nikki informing him that there were Mexicans and midgets in the bassist's garden.
Evangelist Denise Matthews. I don't answer to vanity. I would much rather be a fish stuck in a pond with a starving shark than take on such a foul name of nothingness.
The artist formerly known as Vanity. Former Prince pop protege and girlfriend who turned her affections to her on-again, off-again fiancé Nikki and to freebase cocaine before finding God and becoming a born-again preacher.
Tom Zutat. Nikki told her he wasn't scared by a little bit of blood and proceeded to have intercourse with her right there.
Elektra Records A&R man who signed Motley Crue to the label and suffered the indignity of watching Nikki have sex with his girlfriend 3 minutes after he formally introduced them.
Fred Saunders. I hit Motley a lot. I once broke Tommy's nose in Indiana. I broke Nikki's ribs and I beat the shit out of Vince many times because he's an asshole.
Former Hell's Angel, supplier of Ace in the Hole, and the head of security on numerous Motley Crue world tours.
Bob Timmons. Cocaine gave Nikki acute paranoia and hallucinations. One night he called me and asked me to get the police over to his house right away because there were little men with helmets and guns in the trees surrounding his house.
Former junkie turned drugs counselor to the stars who fought countless valiant but losing battles to have Nikki admitted to rehab.
Slash. I hung out with Nikki and I found a sickening allure in his lifestyle. My junkie years were dirty and sordid, but Nikki seemed to me to have found a cool, glamorous way to be a junkie.
Guns N' Roses guitarist and the little brother that Nikki never had during GNR's infamous 1987 tour of the Deep South with Motley Crue.
Sally McLaughlin.
Slash was paralytic, and Nikki was turning blue.
Former girlfriend of Slash, who moved from Scotland to Los Angeles in 1987 and spent her first day in the city saving Nikki's life.
Karen Dumont. When I moved to Los Angeles, I was told not to even talk to Motley Crue because they were trouble.
Record company employee who took her work responsibilities so seriously that she moved into Nikki's house to try to keep him alive.
Bob Michaels. Once or twice I left my pipe out on the counter, and when I wasn't looking, Nikki sprinkled heroin in it.
Friend, neighbor, and occasional companion in Nikki's rock and roll misadventures.
Ross Halfen. I always said that Tommy should have married Nikki, because if they were gay, they would be the ideal gay couple. Made in heaven.
British photographer who has photographed Motley Crue for nearly 20 years and still thinks Nikki is a likable, selfish, paranoid control freak.
Jason Bryce. Nikki phoned down the reception and said, "Look, I'm Nikki Six. I need a bottle of JD now, and I will give you $1,000 for it." They just told him, "Sir, go to bed. You've had enough."
Callow British teenager who went on the road with Motley Crue as a boy and returned as a man.
Bryn Bridenthal. One of the early things Nikki used to do was set himself on fire during interviews.
Motley Crue publicist who knew nothing about heroin in the 80s, but today, having worked with Nirvana and Courtney Love, is much better informed.
Tim Lutzy. On my first day, Nikki came into the studio with a black eye, having spent the night in a police cell. That pretty much set the tone for what was to follow.
Nikki's bass tech for 10 years, an occupation that occasionally involved enforced Jack Daniels drinking while garbed in the robes of a priest.
Joe Scaleri. Tommy pulled his cock out and started banging it against the desk.
Canadian record company executive who, as a young DJ named Joey Vendetta, hosted one of the most outrageous radio interviews in rock and roll history.
Wayne Isham. Nikki always had the devil's wise-ass smile in his eyes. I guess that's why he always wore sunglasses.
Director of scores of award-winning music videos by the likes of Motley Crue, Ozzy Osbourne, Metallica, Britney Spears, and Nikki's personal favorite, Bon fucking Jovi.
Alan Kovac. Nikki Six may never win a Grammy because the industry does not always judge on talent, but he deserves many.
Head of Los Angeles-based 10th Street Management and current manager of Motley Crue, who helped to negotiate their escape from Elektra Records.
Sylvia Roan. Would I like to take part in this book? I don't think it would be appropriate.
Former CEO of Elektra Records, who figured Motley Crue was spent in the late 90s and sold them the master tapes of their albums.
Rick Nielsen. Nikki Six was a big teddy bear with a nice smile. He could barely play the bass, mind you, but that never stopped Gene Simmons.
Cheap Trick guitarist and Nikki's boyhood hero, friend, and occasional touring and drinking companion.
Bob Rock. Nikki and Tommy decided to dress as Canadian lumberjacks. They put on lumberjack shirts and false mustaches.
A-list rock producer of Motley's Dr. Feelgood and Motley Crue albums, plus records by Aerosmith, Metallica, Bryan Adams, and Bon Jovi.
James Michael. Nikki is a very creative and talented guy, and he thinks in a very dark and twisted way.
Nikki's erstwhile songwriting partner with whom he has co-written hits for Meatloaf and Saliva.